It's my pleasure to welcome Zeph Daniel. Zeph is uniquely qualified to speak as an expert on a number of things. He's a survivor of generational mind control, and among other things, he has escaped from the system and has subsequently spent his time exposing it. As a broadcaster, he has bulldozed a path and begun to pave a way for others like him by being almost a lone voice at one time, for sure, of exposing the satanic system and its infiltration of all levels of society. He has done hundreds of interviews with people specifically in and around these issues, and he is the author of two books, Glass Backwards and Lamb, and several articles. His website is zephnet.com, zephnet.com, and he's the editor of predicto.blogspot.com. He is a preacher and a musician and one who understands the system uniquely and is qualified to help us understand it. Zeph, how are you doing?
Good to be with you, Chris, and I thank you for having me on the show. It's been a while since I've actually done an interview. I don't know why it's been that way, but it's been a while, so it's good to be back on this side of the table, if you will.
Well, it's good to have you. I got a lot of questions that it's hard to find out to pick your brain, and this is one of the best opportunities to do it, for sure.
All right.
The first few questions are kind of open-ended, but I think necessary, and to set the stage kind of thing. Would you give us a biography of your life, if possible, and where did you come from? How did you leave? Where are you at, type of thing?
Well, okay, that's kind of, do you have a couple of days?
I do.
I mean, you know, because as we get older, there's more biography that goes on, right?
Right.
But I was born in Los Angeles in what I would call a very established L.A. family, involved in business, involved in, I guess you would say, a family in the industrialist business, tied in with Hollywood, tied in with... you know, studios and, you know, airplane companies and all kinds of stuff, you know. But I was born into that in the late 50s, actually mid 50s. And what can I say about that period of time? In that period of time is really strange. What's coming to mind to tell you, and I have to just give this whole conversation to the Lord right now and just give it to the Holy Spirit, because I want to know what to say that what people need to hear, you know. Because there's so many things I could talk about, but some of the memories that surfaced for me later were memories of being in situations or seeing, if you will, what we might call satanic with kids and abuse and things like that. And that was, I'd say, before I was 5 years old. You know, I've come to know now from knowing so many people that have come forward and have been honest about satanic ritual abuse, satanic abuse, Satanism, and about that. I should have. The satanic system, I became aware of it before I was 5 years old. I'll just put it that way. And resisted it. You know, not only no, but hell no. But you see, at that time, what could a 5-year old do? You're surrounded by the enemy. So I think I was traumatized at a young age because of that part of the, what we might call the elite satanic system, which I found out isn't so elite. I mean, this is basically. Later on, I find in pretty much any level. So, you know, the typical dysfunctional family, like I say, I was exposed at a young age also to the decadence of people. In other words, you know, what you might see in a Hollywood movie of people going to the racetrack and spending, you know, being drunk and being on drugs and having swinging parties. And, you know, my brother's deceased. He died at 33, he was a victim of a witch and a sacrifice. I mean, oddly enough, so I've lost a brother to this battle. Okay, and he was a Christian. You know, he was a believer in the Lord, and he was a lamb. In other words, he'd never been part of the system either. You know, how did he and I not become part of the system? I don't know. That's really strange. We were sent to psychiatrists early on, Rick and me, and why? Because they could. I don't know what it was, but they couldn't really get to us. We just weren't really getting with it as we were getting older. And so we were basically being sent to shrinks to figure out what was wrong with us. Why won't we get along and get with it and become part of the matrix? Why? And it's a very curious thing. Why? Anyway, as my mother would tell people about me, she said, he rebelled against this whole thing since, you know, day one. I also was aware when I was an adolescent in Los Angeles, I was aware of, you know, people getting picked up, people that were like me getting, you know, not making it through, whether they committed suicide or whether, you know, just awful things happening. You know, it was a real battle back in the, at that time, because so many people were dying right, left, straight, everywhere around me. And the people who weren't dying, the kids who weren't dying, they were going on into college and into, you know, they work in prestigious law firms. They work in Washington for the Bush administration. They, you know what I mean? They're the movers and shakers of the world today.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen that aspect. And I've also, you know, having been in this situation, surrounded by what you might call the elites or whatever, but I had no frame of reference because for me it was just normal, you know, that was just the world. And but I was aware that when people didn't like something, for example, they were able to fix it, okay, with the courts, with grand juries, with respect to, you know, people testifying, say, against an insurance company or an insurance claim, and they just disappear. You know, it's kind of like I grew up in the, on the set of L.A. Confidential. Remember that movie about L.A., about the corruption? Well, in our family, they were pretty much ruling over L.A. at that time and ruling over that kind of, you know, that was L.A. at that time. You had, that's where you had the biggest glitz and glamour of Hollywood at the same time. You had all that pomp and circumstance, all those, you know, the premieres where there'd be thousands and thousands of people thronging around at the Chinese Theater for the, to see the stars. And you had Howard Hughes and you had, you know, Bob Hope and all these different people who were all involved. And I actually met most of those as a child, people like that. And it was very interesting to read Bryce Taylor's book, Thanks for the Memories. Have you seen that one? Or do you think your audience knows about that book?
They probably do.
Well, in that book, it was so funny because here's a woman, you know, writing about her experiences as a child from another perspective, not from inside, say, elite life of Los Angeles, but coming from more of a middle-class situation, coming from Woodland Hills, but being sold into it by her father. And being then used and groomed to be, you know, a sex slave, at the same time a computer for Henry Kissinger. But she names in that book all these different things about Los Angeles that were, that I could confirm, and about Bob Hope and about all this stuff. And I can just say the underbelly that she describes of LA, I cannot argue with it. And I can say that the things she was writing about and the places that she named, I can confirm that those are authentic. I wasn't there as an eyewitness of her, but I can say that what she's naming about the L.A. Dodgers and about USC School of Dentistry, about the USC College itself, about Pepperdine College in Malibu, about this whole L.A. scene run by the L.A., what I call the L.A. Mafia, which are not Italian, okay? It's a different kind of mafia. Anyway, also includes the Italian Mafia, but I mean, isn't they aren't the head of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole world of industry, of Hollywood, like I say, you know, movie business, industry, you know, Boeing, Northrop is out there. You've got Lockheed. You have that moved from there later, but they were also a Los Angeles firm. You have just a real booming, wild situation in L.A. from the 1930s, I would say, all the way, especially into the 40s and through World War II, and then after World War II as well, especially. And then eventually these companies kind of dispersed, but you had quite a number of movers and shakers, of corporate movers and shakers in the world, industries located in Southern California at that time, in and around Los Angeles. So my family were involved with all those, you know, on the boards of all those companies, that, you know, in especially war. They were very, very much, I would say, conservative. They were for war. They were people that got, you know, Nixon elected, for example, very right-wing, warlike kind of, you know, the Prescott Bush, people like international globalists like Armin Hammer and people like that were always, you know, around. See what I mean?
Yeah.
We're talking about the actual people that have shaped the world to be what it is today. We're talking about people that actually make presidents president. And it's all connected, in, of course, with international politics, international business, international banking, and internationalism. But you have L.A., you've got New York, you've got, you know, Europe, you've got the different, you know, different power centers. And so I was exposed to, I guess, this power center of big business, industry, studios, entertainment, you know, the beast as we see it. And basically, the policy is not if you will be a Satanist, but how would you like to survive and not become a sacrifice? You will become that. Hmm. So, you know, I'm a kind of a guy, you know, back when I was watching, you know, television and things like that, when I went to the movies, I was always, you know, loving hero movies, you know, where the hero stands up against the evil system and wins. I had those kind of morals. I don't know what it was, but my instinct was to fight and not just give in. And, of course, that got me, I mean, like, I remember there would be like a cloudy day and someone would say, hey, thanks a lot for the cloudy day. I'd say, I didn't cause that to happen. What are you talking about? But this was the beginning of the oppression, the beginning of trying to trigger us. And then, you know, there were like schools where they would have kids, you know, like we would be at a swim school, and then they would tell all the kids to take their trunks off. And it was like, I'm not doing that. but you know, the adults were always messing with kids. I mean, everywhere you look, whether it was the coach, whether it was the, you know, all of this stuff going on. And then at the same time, I was well aware at an early age of spirits, you know, like just disincarnate beings being around and having control over the people that were around me, supposedly as my caregivers. So I felt a great deal of what flipped me out, if you will, or what made me so terribly depressed, I suppose, was this feeling of total betrayal. Like, I felt betrayed by the whole thing, you know, like I'm betrayed by everyone. I mean, nobody had anybody's back. You just had to become part of this system. You had to become part of this satanic system at an early age, or you were considered a failure and should be killed, period. And most people were killed. I only know of one other person that was a survivor. I pray that he's okay. And I remember that we were in at a dinner, a planned. There's other aspects to this, like the Truman Show, but you know, that are really weird, really strange. But so we're at this arranged little dinner, and with these people that are kind of like in society there, and basically the name of this guy that was a good friend of ours in school, and I know the husband of this woman, this sort of Jezebel woman that's sitting there kind of orchestrating everything in an Italian restaurant in Brentwood. We're sitting there. She goes, well, remember Bill, I won't say his last name. And I go, yeah, hey, yeah, Bill, I love that guy. Hey, how's he doing? You know, and she goes, he's still out there, and we're going to get him. Get him? That's how he was. What do you mean, get him? Now, at that particular time, when I was at this particular dinner, how's my mind? I wasn't going around like a kid going, yeah, it's all real. This is this deep, dark, horrible, demonic thing is all real. No, no, I was taken out of there, you know, locked up in the loony bin, you know, given therapy, told to kill myself. And these people that were actually in there were only people like me there. There were kids, you know, who basically were like lambs that could, you know, they couldn't force them through. I'm assuming that everyone in the audience knows what that means.
Right, right.
Okay, so I don't want to go into, you know, I spent a lot of time on my show explaining point by point dissecting the whole thing. But basically, it's, you know, so these kids go to these hospitals, and what happens this in the case of one girlfriend I had, she was given shock treatments until she became a zombie, and then she was sent home, and her father still to this day controls her every move, you know, things like that. And they just break, you know, they're there to be broken. It's not about therapy, and people have roommates in these places, they're not really roommates, they're plants. They're people, you know, they're plants and who are trying to influence. The whole point is to get somehow to get these kids through to the other side so they can then go home and maybe recover their lives. But usually they wound up as sacrifices. In other words, they wound up dead. All of them. Pretty much.
And well, obviously, yeah, I was just saying, you obviously are malfunctioning in their system. So I'd see it's, which is a great thing. Just want to see how did that end up? How did you break free? I mean, obviously you're speaking out so loudly now that they wouldn't dare touch you, I guess.
Well, I have there was a guy now that's like an assassin. Hey, I hate to have, yeah, I got, he's a nice person, you know, he's out of it now, but I mean, that was his deal. And he just said, you better keep talking. or someone like me will show up.
All right.
And that was kind of a warning. Yeah, no, it's real. They do pick us off. They do. I was told that they were going to pick me off when I was like 16. You better, with the program, they're going to pick you off. Yeah, there's a big eagle flying out of the sky, and you're just like a little rabbit, you know? And that eagle sees that rabbit, and boom, that's it. I'm like, is that supposed to scare me? You already have me locked up. I mean, what more do you want? Anyway, there was no, you know, there was no, I think what they realized is there was no returning. So, yeah, they tried to kill me, and I was in a coma. And, you know, from an overdose of phenobarbital that I was given by this, you know, music teacher in college, believe it or not, a guy that I later ended up confronting in life. He didn't know who it was, but I mean, this was, you know, I survived that. I woke up from the coma. And at that time, I think what they all thought was, well, obviously God has a purpose for him. So by this time, I'm out of society and I'm gone. And then eventually I'm taken to the Midwest, where I was put in the Menninger Foundation, which was a psychiatric hospital for, I guess, for people that, like me, you know, I mean, people from, you know, society that, you know, broken lambs or whatever, kids that couldn't get with the program. So there we were, there. And eventually, once I was in the Midwest, they told me not to come back there again to Los Angeles. So here I was in Topeka, Kansas, and they had a kind of a big campus there. And I was there for a while. There was really nothing wrong with me. You know, there was nothing wrong with any of the kids I met there. All from similar circumstances, from Chicago and New York and, you know, Miami and you know, different big cities, right?
Mm-hmm.
There'd be family meetings, you know, and it was incredible how this whole dual layer thing was going on. But at the same time, in those environments, I was in several of those kind of environments. And in one, I was, you know, I was abused. I mean, I was terribly, terribly, horribly traumatized, abused, and tortured in one situation where, it, you know, it involved, you know, rape, sexual assault on me. They tried to kill me with drugs. In other words, they put something in me that should have killed me and didn't, and I got away and I escaped that and I hid out for a while. I mean, I was like a fugitive. I mean, I was basically a dead man walking, or a child. I was really still underage. And so so there I was in, you know, having, you know, done all this battle, and here they are, you know, again trying to kill me or trying to just traumatize me for some reason. What happened was that I became shattered, I think, you know, the trauma, the betrayal, and the torturing, you know, physical torture, like, for example, giving you a drug that will make your mouth stick to the roof, you can't sleep, and your tongue is stuck to the, I think it was like Haldol or something like that. It was, you have to have some other drug with it, or your tongue is stuck to the roof of your mouth. And they would just leave me stuck to it like that, and, or give me Thorazine, and then, like I said, there were other people in the rooms that were plants, who are homosexuals trying to, you know, rape and do everything they can do to you, you know. It was amazing. I would expect that from a guy like Wayne Marin. You know Wayne from, he's told his story about the abuses at the Napa State hospital. But these different places. They were like every doctor there was like a little Joseph Mengele, you know. Couldn't wait to, because once you're in there, they could do whatever they want to you.
Mm-hmm.
So rape, trauma abuse, mind control, hypnosis, shock treatments, all that, you know, and more. Even threats of lobotomy if you didn't get with the program.
Hmm.
And all that's controlled by the society. In other words, they own that. It's got nothing to do with therapy. That's the first thing you realize. You know, and so all you think about is escaping. Well, yeah, you know, but then the world is, you know, the world. So there were many different attempts at, like, murder, poisoning, and I've had that throughout the year. So how did I get out? Well, I think we've been at battle all this time. I mean, I'm still damaged physically from poison that I was given. I'm still trying to recover my own, you know, from post-traumatic stress and all that, which you know, so how that works is someone can see you somewhere that you've never been, and they do something, and it triggers you, and it triggers this horrible feeling of being under assault. It's such a terrible trauma to know they're looking for you to kill you, and you're hiding. And when it gets triggered like that, suddenly, no matter what environment you're in, you could be in a store, you could be at a football game, you could be, all of a sudden, everyone turns into one of these people that's going to get you. Now, that's not really happening. It's going on in your head, you know, in your mind, but it's from the trauma. You know, and maybe that's a survival instinct. You know, it could be. But most of these people were multiple personalities that were the controllers, handlers, movers, and shakers. They had different aspects of themselves. In my own situation, there are members of the Bohemian Club, and you've heard of that, right?
Yeah.
After Alex Jones.
Right.
I don't think anyone hasn't heard of that.
Right.
But the Bohemian Club is different from the actual event at Bohemian Grove. The Bohemian Club is a club in San Francisco. It's a very elite club. Only the top people in the world belong to it. And, of course, what do they do in their off time? They dress up like women and import homosexual boys and have orgies with guys. Then they act like, well, that didn't really happen. The public's mind controlled to think, oh, that didn't really happen. But that's a big part of what goes on. Pedophilia, homosexuality, but not like the gay community sort of thing, although I'm not saying it's separate from that. I'm saying it's just these people have their more power in shame and guilt and secrecy. The power of shame and guilt, rather, I should say, from secrecy, keeping that thing secret, then initiating the boys in and the girls in, you know, you spring it on them before they know what's going on and try to initiate them in. Well, later in comes about that same period of time, and we're talking about like late 60s and early 70s and stuff, and about that same time you have the whole rock and roll invasion where, you know, you've got people like Led Zeppelin. People think Led Zeppelin are more modern. They don't realize the first Led Zeppelin record came out in 1969. 1970 at the latest, okay?
Mm-hmm.
By the time they did Stairway to Heaven and all that, there was like 1973, if I'm not mistaken, 74, let's say, 73, 72. That's quite a while ago. Well, back at that time, you know, you hear Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin singing about there are two ways you can go. I'm going, yeah, exactly. So this whole campaign is going on across the board. At the same time, you had the Beatles with their White Album and all that, which is just, it was all the same kind of mind control stuff, all the same horror that they were putting us through. It was just unbelievable horror. Only thing they're not mentioning is how death and spilling blood is really the biggest part of it.
Right.
You know, bloodletting, and it's not just sex, it's blood. You know, and so arranging sacrifice, that's why lambs get killed. Lambs meaning those that aren't going to be conformed to that way. They just are made differently. They're just not.
Zep, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. What's happening is suddenly there's a power drain on this battery. This is a fresh phone with a new charge.
Ouch.
Sorry. Okay. But anyway, so that I was well aware at that same time that there was a huge campaign going on across the board to get kids into this system, you know. And under the guise of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and rebellion against the man. When there's, I was like trying to tell him, you idiots, don't you realize this is the man? Plant and those people, and Hendrix, even all those people, they sold out to the man. They sold out. They're singing the praises of the man. And I don't know whether it's stupidity on the part of American kids, or I don't really understand how they got to thinking that something like Sir Mick Jagger was a rebel. How did they ever get him on stage?
What's that?
Because he wears a costume and dances or prances around something that seems sassy and rebellious. I mean, this guy is like, he's the chairman of the board. He's in the three-piece suit, laughing. That's just a costume. And he's in politics. It's politics and industry and all this stuff. In the world, you're going to have all these things linked up together. You know, and it's kind of like, okay, so you have a decision to make. Are you going to, you know, I cannot even explain how I'm, the odds on my being here right now are about 1,000,000,000,000,000. So I have to stick with, you know, God, because, you know, with Jesus Christ, because he is the only reason that I got through any of it. Now, Chris, all this was repeated again. I have to be, you know, really clear about what kind of condition I was in, because after all this happened, and I was in the Menninger Foundation and all that, when they let me out, basically it was to play in bands, to play drums in bands, which I was telling you before the show. Okay, so that was my career trait, because that's what I could do, and I was very, very good at it. So I was able to go out and make a living. You know, from L.A., they divorced themselves of me. So I got out of there onto, like, the streets of Topeka, Kansas. I was in a $50 a month apartment. I was playing drums and bands. I couldn't be happier. The only problem is, by the time that happened, I'd forgotten everything that I just told you. I don't know what happened in my mind. I'm just telling you, it was all like, I agreed that it must have just been diluted. I must have had a... Now I'm okay. See what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't see any of that stuff. See, they wouldn't have ever let me out of there if I kept saying I'd seen any of that stuff.
Right.
So I said, I don't know what you... Yeah. And I remember there was family meetings where they told me there weren't, you know, there was an incident where they were waiting for me, and I told them to F off, and the next day they were going to kill me, and they were all waiting, and they're hiding all throughout the house. Hiding. I arrived there, and I knew that. I got a knife. You know, I knew that. My girlfriend dropped me off right at the right moment, of course. Was that my girlfriend? No, it was, all these were actors on it. I'm the only one that didn't know this was a play. Mm-hmm. So I get there, and I held them all off with a knife and scared them. You know, they were hiding in different, you know, doors locked, and I, you know, stabbed the knife in the door. You know, I did. It was very dramatic, you know, very, very Rosemary's Baby-like scene. Mm-hmm. And the next day, there was an ambulance there with a court order to take me away because I'm, you know, insane or whatever. And all these people, of course, and all their cars that were hidden in the alley and different places, those disappeared. And they said, well, there weren't people there that night, were there? And I said, oh, no, I don't remember anyone there. That was just in my head. Or else I would have never gotten out.
Right.
I had to agree there were no people there that night. See, and this is years. They worked on me. That was 3 years later. So that was, you know, years of conditioning to the point where I wouldn't know that was, you know, obviously I was mistaken about any satanic ritual or killing or sodomy, you know, criminal pedophilia. None of that was going on. I didn't see anything. See no evil, hear no evil, do no evil, okay? So now remember, I'm in the Midwest. I'm not there. I did somehow get out. I had already suffered a coma. I'd already been, you know, and then I survived it. I wasn't supposed to, and that was their sacrifice. So it was really getting out and playing drums, you know, getting by them and the people that were on the board of trustees of the Mangrum Foundation, these were all the people that were in Hollywood, in L.A. They were on the board. So they had control. See, they, you know what I mean? They had control. And they just said, you know, well, this guy, this one that got away, just tell him to never come back here again. Maybe he can get a farm out there in Kansas and just forget it, this whole thing ever happened. So I got out. And then I was playing drums, like I said. But here's what happened. I just, something was gnawing at me to go back to L.A. I had to go back to find out what happened. And somehow the opportunity came where, you know, there was the ability to go. So I went, you know, and I sort of worked in real estate, and I kind of, you know, I wasn't really doing music. It was sort of killing me, but I knew that if I kept pursuing music, if I tried to pursue it in L.A., there would be this whole problem all over again. So, but I didn't know what the problem was consciously. I just felt, I just moved away from it. You see, I just kept moving. But I had to find out what happened, because I, at this point, I don't know. All the history I have is pretty much wiped out. I don't know who I am. I don't know where I came from. I don't know. But to me, everything is like Disneyland. So I get back there, and I remember I developed a case of having panic attacks, and I couldn't really go out during the day. I got to the so bad that I just couldn't wait in a line, started becoming totally agoraphobic. And but I found that I could, you know, I could go to school at night, let's say. So I decided to, you know, I was kind of on, you might call it disability, and I started going and taking screenwriting classes, because I really had to write something. So I could go there at night without panicking, you know, in the car. I don't know why I could go there at night, but I could, you know, it was kind of, you had to grit your teeth, and I had to, you know, get through a couple of long signals on, I remember on Highland, that one drove me nuts. But I would drive down this Highland, for people who are in Los Angeles, and there was a little screenwriting school called the Hollywood Screenwriting Institute or something like that. I don't know. It was in the middle of Hollywood. And I would get there, and somehow I, you know, it was like a, everything was new. It was like, wow, this is, this will work. And I mean, I thought I was crazy, but here I'm taking this class, and the good people around, and we're sharing our stories, and learning a new craft, learning a trade, learning a, you know, about screenwriting. I thought it was really cool. And so I took to writing a screenplay, you know, and I, the thing I was writing, it was giving me like cold sweats at night. It was horrifying when I was writing. I, as soon as I learned the kind of the format of how to write a script, I started writing a script called Society, and I was hiding the thing in a drawer, you know, hiding it. And it got so bad, I didn't really understand what was, it was about a kid in Beverly Hills who, basically, his parents raise him to sacrifice him. and they're all involved in occult magical rituals. And, you know, they eventually made a movie out of it, but I have to tell you the thing, that that's not what I wrote. And what I wrote was really, really, really amazing, you know, in terms of just revealing stuff. And then they, what they did is they took it and they made it, but they goofed it all up and they made it so it wasn't, you know, with ambiguous, you know, they hid a lot of the truth. I'm sorry about that. But now I realize why they did it. You know, they were never going to make a movie straight out, you know, like my book Lamb, for example, it's pretty much just directly all this kind of stuff. You see it in Lamb about blood sacrifice and kids with psychiatrists, and, you know, you see the way the elites are, and you see the churches doing satanic rituals and having orgies, a guy killing his own wife and children in front of them to get higher up in the Illuminati, blah, 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 da-da-da-da. It's just across the board. From page one all the way through, it's dealing with the same thing. In fact, I've been dealing with that same thing. But anyway, in writing that, well, when they finally were going to make the film, I didn't care if they changed the script. I didn't have any integrity. You know, I was just amazed someone was going to do something with it. But I remember when I went to, there was the assistant of the casting person I had known before. She used to teach tennis there at my, where my mother lives. And she called me up and she goes, you know, that screenplay, blah, 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 they're making it. And she goes, well, it's all real. I said, what? See, I wrote this thing, and then I got someone else involved to help write the ending because I couldn't do it anymore because I was having panic attacks writing it. It was freaking me out. Why would I lock it in a drawer? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Well, it's not pornography, right? I'm locking this in a drawer. Anyway, so they're making it, and she calls me, and she goes, it's all real. And I sort of, at that point, I lost it totally. See, I didn't know when I was writing it what I was writing about. Unlike Duncan. Duncan's got, one of your interviews to Duncan O'Finian, and my interview and a friend of mine, too. He's writing a screenplay about his experiences, but he knows what he's writing about. And he's working with someone out there to make it a film. At that time, I didn't know. I mean, I wasn't connected up with it, And so what happened is when she called this person that eventually she married, some very wealthy guy and lives there now, she said, it's all real. And talked to me about, I'm not going to go into some of the gross details of it, but it's all real. And so I went running off to Italy. I just bailed out of town. I was so frightened I left town. I was just absolutely terrified that this was all real. In fact, the entire exercise of even doing this film was all just like me being on the Truman Show. I don't even think there was a reason for it to be made, And then eventually the filmmakers end up saying, well, this was a film about teenage alienation. So, I was just boy interrupted, and I returned back to where I was when I was a teenager to fix the pieces of my broken life to figure out what happened. Of my shattered mind or whatever, what happened? It was a massive cover-up. And everybody, I think, understood that it was real, except me. Which was the most bizarre thing. You know how things come around like that, where you end up facing your past and your destiny and all that? This was one of those moments. And I couldn't accept it. And after that, what happened is, I hooked up with this girl in Italy, and, she was another handler controller working with them, and they had me all back under in good shape again. In other words, everything was handled after that. I returned back to L.A., unaware of, again, it was one of these things like, that wasn't really real. That never happened. Okay. Anyway, so it all came back again. It really took till, so that was handled. Then we went off, let's say we went into the 90s, and even there I'm still in denial. So it isn't really until toward the end of the 90s that I, or to the mid-90s, let's say, that I have another, let's call it awakening about all this. And then I, basically at that point I just do what I usually do. In the first place where they had me incarcerated, and somehow someone slipped me some LSD there, how that got in there, I guess that was just a convenient thing. And this guy, who's like my roommate, he's trying to handle me. He's trying to control me. He's trying to get me into the mind control. So now I'm all juiced up on LSD, and I'm freaking out. I'm having a bad trip. And at that time, I just had called on Jesus, and this was, I was 17 or 16, called on Jesus. And I just had this vision of Jesus glowing. He was there in my room, and he just overpowered the whole room. And suddenly that trip that I was on was eradicated instantaneously. And this guy who was a professional plant, he was not a patient. He posed as a patient, like, I'm your roommate, but he wasn't my roommate. He was assigned to me. Anyway, he flipped out so much at the appearance of Jesus, because we both saw him. That he had to be hauled off to ICU that day. And I went out and joined the other kids and played volleyball that night. I was playing volleyball, lucid as you could, like nothing ever happened. So Jesus always was the protector. I need to say that because, otherwise I'd be giving credit to myself for having slipped away and,
Right.
It's still terrifying for me to think about all this, since my particular life seems to have been a horror movie, and it's just like the whole thing is a horror movie. It's like going to a horror movie for 50 years. I feel like I've been in a horror movie for 50 years. everywhere you turn, it's another thing. It's just the same horror movie. My dreams, I can't get away from it. It's still there. When I wake up, I can't get away from it. It's still there. Well, yeah, it's the world.
So
I
what
became vocal toward the end of the 90s, especially into the, you know, into the turn of the century, because at that time the Lord had chosen me for ministry, you know, and the, you know, and chosen me for to heal me, to bring me all together, so I would see those, so I would integrate all my experiences into one under one roof, and He was the one that made that happen, completely, totally by Yahweh Himself, by the Father of all, by the Creator of all things. He was the one who actually helped me to face all this stuff. And He said, you know, you're so damaged at this point. And He's almost, it was, I could almost feel like just angels weeping over why they do this to children. But I guess it goes into the fact that children really don't matter that much. It's the system that means everything, not children. See, that's what people don't say on these talk shows. The society is everything. The individual is nothing. That's why children get hurt. It's justified by the fact that if this all got out and people knew that they lived in this cesspool situation, you see, the system would fail. It's all about society staying society, the good society. And a good person is one who is mind-controlled that says, yes, I'm Rosemary, I've just given birth to the devil, and now I'm going to rock the cradle. If anyone remembers Rosemary's Baby, that's exactly how it is. It's just like that. You know? And so, you know, I said, hell no, I'm not going to rock the cradle. And fuck you people for trying to, you know, ensnare me. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, it's all good.
Okay. So I've just had this, you know, and where did it all get me? I don't know. I went out on the internet in 2002, and I had written Lamb, I remember, and then, which the first time I really attempted a novel, which was multi-plotting, and just the Lord wanted me to write it, and I wrote that. And then I wrote a book called Glass Backwards, which was my letter, if you will, to Hollywood, done in a satirical manner. In other words, it's written as a satire. It's written with some wit. It's wit, because I've been writing for 20 years. I've been writing all this time. I began as a poet. I've been writing all my life. It was one of my therapies for surviving. And then lately was given music to that same kind of therapy, because it's very helpful in helping me to integrate, you know. In other words, to keep from going into I don't think I can ever go into denial again, but... You know, basically I was a guy with amnesia or with something, you know, all that time, nothing was real. All that time, any kind of employment I had was all arranged. And everything I had was arranged by others to make it look like a real job, to make it look like a real life. You know, a simulated life is what it was. So they didn't kill me when I got there because I was no threat. I mean, I was just crazy. Right? I was no threat to anyone because the time it got hairy again was in L.A. I had to leave Los Angeles again. Finally, I left after all of it was integrated. I confronted all these people, and they were fixing to kill me all over again, the same exact scenario once again, but we slipped away. We got away. But I had to find out. So I found out, and then I left. And then I went on the internet, and that's basically my biography. I mean, I'm not hitting every little thing, but it's not that exciting because it's basically, Z is in horror land and has been there in horror land all this time, and now he's out. But guess what? It's all horror land.
Mm-hmm. But now you've cut ties. There's no more handling. They know what you know. Now you're speaking out there. They can't do anything, or they can, but they won't, because it'll give credibility to you. And you've been interviewing all these people that have been probably great therapy and confirming everything. And I guess my question is, you know, after assimilating and understanding all this stuff that you've learned now, what if you could kind of explain how the system works, how they are able to keep it hidden. What are the motivators and the demotivators? How can it be in plain sight yet completely invisible?
Well, now I'm going to sound like a crazy man, but see, the thing I didn't tell you, good that you've asked this, is that the controllers, ultimately humans. You know, the system isn't run by men, by human beings. It's not handed over to men to do. It's run by, what you might call the fallen angels, if you will, or demonic entities. And, I'm going to bring in the UFO thing, or aliens, if you will. That's who run all these people. In fact, they're all connected in. That's the thing that was so funny about the UFO business. It's like, wait a second, these people fly around in UFOs all the time, and their demons are all inhabit all of them, and they're basically, they're not even who they were. Most of them are the another entity jumps in and takes them over because a door opens, and the door that opens is when they agree to go through the other side. They get the very powerful demons that run these high social circles that control the world. And so you have the demonic, then you have the people that serve the demonic, and they're the ones that get to play kings and presidents. And it's all an act. They're not. There's no elections or anything. They're just appointed. This whole thing is a facade. It's all like that movie The Matrix. It's all pretty much, controlled. What you see is not real. But these people, for whatever reason, if you want to be a mover, shaker, controller of the thing, you find out pretty quickly when you go through who your daddy is, if you know what I mean.
Right.
You find out that you're going to serve the devil and that's it. And no one calls him the devil. They just, they just have their, they don't talk about it like that. It's just something they know. But what's in them isn't them. It's like they go to sleep or they get put in the back seat. Someone else is driving the bus, or the car. I'm just mixing metaphors horribly, but I'm just trying to find a way to. And they all are linked telepathically with each other. And they all fight each other for position as well. There's always fights going on.
Well, now I've heard you describe most of the people that you associated with in L.A. and others were multiples, and all the people kind of in this big system are multiples.
That's right.
MPD is used to...
When I say multiple, there's the classic multiple that is the person that has, like, a different name. Like, here's, in one person you could have, Tom, who's a 16-year-old adolescent. You have Joe, who's a 45-year-old professional. You have Ben, who is, let's say an old man, and Steve, who is, or Greta, who's a 10-year-old girl, all in one person.
Right, and they create these obviously for you can get them to do things, be their slave, and it's good for the system, but yet it's also used to create a vessel for demonic attachment. What percentage of the generational MPD people are indwelt with demonic entities and I know that you were a multiple because of the trauma-based mind control to some extent, and how did you avoid any of the indwelling of demonic attachment, and how does that work?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I was a multiple in the sense of having actual other names. Do you know what I mean? But then the testimony I just gave shows there's some multiplicity going on. There have to be. I've talked to Russ Dizdar about this as a minister, And I've talked to him about my situation. His assessment is that I have been, my personality was, I was hurt, fragmented, but I didn't become one of them to be brought up in their system. You see what I mean? So I just remained broken and fragmented and just like a piece of me over here, a piece of me over there. You could easily control me. It's hard for me to really answer this because I don't have the same exact testimony as someone like, say, Judy that we interview that, her story or some of other, or Duncan himself who you've interviewed.
Right.
And it's different. But, yes, they do. They were able to control me just as easily as you please. So there had to be something going on or they wouldn't know they could control me.
it seems to be, you know, yet that they are shattering a person's psyche in the system that they've perfected. And I wonder, do they do that to, I mean, it's still about free will at some point. Do they get one of the personalities to accept, you know, the satanic patriotism or, and thereby, you know, demonic attachment and all the rest of it? Or I mean, is it just a matter of because the psyche's shattered, it's easier for a demon to walk into the situation?
You have to get through to their side. You have to die to whoever you were and have a demonic, you know, it has to take. Be no tiki, no washi. So if that conversion hasn't taken, if that demon isn't indwelling the person, you know, in other words, and then you're all part of the world, you know, or the world system. But if that thing hasn't happened within you, it doesn't matter what ritual you do or if you do what they tell you to do, it hasn't happened. See what I mean? You're not part of them. So in other words, I guess to answer the question, it would be this. What they're looking for is that conversion. So in the case of people that fight it, like me, and they tell you to accept it, that's okay, I'd love to accept it. Please. Here, I accept it. I've even gone to that point. I accept it. Still didn't happen. See? So there's no, what can they do with a person like that?
Right.
You know, it didn't happen. Hey, look here, demon, I'm over here. Hey, come on in. Go ahead, I'll change. Here, take, you know, whatever it is. You know, here's my body. Here, whatever sexual act you want me to do, whatever it is. Here it is. Come on, take me. Here I am. I want money, man.
Right, and they use the money and everything else as motivators for people, and I think that's why, you know, you were describing the pedophilia at the highest levels of these movers and shakers and everything, and that's obviously a motivator, and people that are quote-unquote rising stars, you know, that would, you know, be used as just any number of things. And obviously, if there is demonic attachment, it's kind of a military system of control. You know, they answer to their superiors in a sense. So when that's triggered, they answer like a military system. I think
it's exactly like the military, the whole thing. And you know, you have people that have power, and then they have people under them. And I remember they would like throw spells on me, and then they would send others, not the spell thrower, but another person that would come over to check to see how it went. You know, because they want to, if you're not part of their system, they like to use you as a battery, you know. So there's one function you have, like you have talents, you have energy, you have whatever you have gifts, okay? And they want those gifts. So what they do is they basically, to what they do to lambs, in other words, people that can't go through, they traumatize you, kind of like in the insect world, like what a spider does, you know. They traumatize you. They tie you up by surrounding you with other people. They throw spells and things at you to degrade you, to do harm to you. And as your life is going down, they're sucking off that energy. They're sucking off that trauma, you know, the people around you are. And you're feeding them because they have to feed off others. They have to feed off innocent blood. They got to feed on other people in order to keep their thing going, because they're cut off from God. Remember that. So they've learned, like vampires, to feed off one another, and especially off innocent blood. So they're traumatizing you. They like you to go down slow. So they degrade you. They'll set you up with people that will betray you. They'll stab you in the back. It's all planned so that you'll be brought to your knees, and eventually you'll cry out either, uncle, you'll be so broken that you'll just pass through the other side, or they will just degrade you till there's nothing left and then have you kill yourself. And that's why they tolerate people that aren't through to the other side. They have to have plenty of these people around to prey upon, or they would fade out themselves.
Well, let's talk about the people that aren't in the system. What if someone acquires independent wealth or power? I used to say Bill Gates is an example for this, but now I'm kind of wondering if Bill Gates' father in the whole situation, maybe he is part of the system or was generational. But let's just say somebody like that that has acquired independent wealth or power and there is therefore a threat to their system because they could affect some sort of change. How do they rein them in? How do they control them? What is a method for that?
It's just the same thing as the mafia. You know, do you love your children? You know, it's that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, we'll kill what you love, and then you'll have to be a witness to all of it. So are you going to protect your morals and your principles and risk your kids? You know what I mean? They can get to anybody. They are the world. They can get to anybody.
And I bet there are things that they can't. I mean, is it rare to bring somebody into the satanic system? I mean, I look at, like, the Bohemian Grove as a la Alex Jones's, you know, whatever, as maybe a possible way to bring somebody like that into it to say, hey, look at this kind of party, you know, this is how we party, and if they, you know, are into the whole the sacrifice thing, then they might be shown a deeper ritual or something to that effect. But would you say that for the most part, the satanic end is for the generational types?
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, that there could be, you know, there are these generational things going on, and then there's outsiders. Well, in my own family, they were outsiders at the time of my grandfather's generation, and he wanted in, and he got in. So he was not well, he may have, but his father committed suicide. That would be my great-grandfather committed suicide, and he had to quit going to school to take care of his mother, you know, and they all had to go to work, and they were in very hard-scrabble circumstances. My grandmother came from just shanty Irish, you know, she was working in brothels with, you know, for her dad when she was 10, 12 years old. You know what I'm saying? No one even called it pedophilia then.
Right.
I mean, that was just going on. You know, that was life, hard, tough. And so they wanted a better life. Mm-hmm. I remember in the case of my own grandfather, he was a painter, an artist. You know, pretty good, too. Great landscapes, very interesting stuff. He was really wanting to be an artist. But then at some point he got tired of being poor, and, you know, he had tremendous gifts, tremendous abilities. And he just suppressed that artist part of him. He went to work in the insurance business, and he just, you know, went all the way to taking over to being assigned for Los Angeles finally, you know, and from San Francisco, and then got there during the heyday, really the heyday of Los Angeles, and became a major socialite and just major player in the world. But he bootstrapped himself into that. Could he have made it without them? No. It does mean a guy can't invent something, but the way, you know, in other words, when you're dealing with companies like insurance business, and you're dealing with people businesses, and you need to make contacts, and you have to, you know, interface with airplane companies and parts companies and car makers and, you know, different things like that, and hotel people that build hotels and golf courses and parties and Hollywood and this and that. You know, you're dealing with people. What are you going to do? Say, no, I'm the one guy that's really pure, but I want you all to love me?
True.
He had to go there.
Right. And now that the system is so, you know, with the corporate system and it being so fewer and fewer people in power and consolidation of power, it's almost impossible to do anything at all without conforming in some way. Speaking of hotel empires, I've heard you speak of Paris Hilton recently as a multiple, somebody that is definitely in the system. And, you know, we suspect your Britneys and Lindsay Lohans and Nicole's and others.
I can't prove it. I mean, I have a suspicion,
not.
That's all.
I think you've probably seen, you know, Freeman's take on the Britney and what is it, Anna Nicole thing and others, and some of the evidence is there. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention about it was I almost see it like the media focuses on their every move is kind of like a testament to the control freak nature of these people, you know, that they must control every aspect of the news and that they take very little chances in anything being, you know, consumed that they aren't 100% sure of the outcome of. Do you see it as that, as far as what they give us to consume as the news and other things?
Let me dispel for one second the generational thing. Can we talk about the Hilton family for one sec, since you brought it up? And, well, Conrad Hilton was in the same position my grandfather was in. He was from Socorro, New Mexico. Just a poor boy. Not connected. All right? And he had to work with others. He actually had to work with my grandfather to finance his early hotels. Okay? But, yeah, I know. It's interesting, isn't it? There's a tie there.
Right.
But neither one of those men, Conrad Hilton nor my grandfather, neither one of them were made men. Neither one of them were generational. You might have thought that the Hilton family was generational.
Right.
No? Well, a generational in this sense, there was Conrad, and then there was Baron, after that. And there was Nick Hilton, who was married to Elizabeth Taylor. I think he died. He committed suicide, I believe. I'm really not quite clear on that. I think. Okay. And then it was Baron Hilton that actually took over the corporation and was running it after Conrad. And then the parents of Paris Hilton, right? So that'd be the third generation who are now running the corporation, or, you know, I'm really not sure what the ownership of the Hilton Hotel thing is, but, you know, it's now the third generation where those kids who would be, you know, like, for example, Rick Hilton, I believe, is it Rick who's the... Is Rick Paris's father? Well, anyway, so he would be my generation, and then there's Paris. See what I mean? And that's as far. It doesn't go all the way back to the Queen of England.
Right. But they would certainly sell their kids into the system. I mean, that's kind of the way it goes, right? It's kind of their ticket to ride.
If you read Conrad Hilton wrote a book called Be My Guest, and in that book he describes how it was and how his background, it came from a kind of a poor Catholic background in New Mexico, but he had a goal, a dream. I mean, on the outside it looks like the perfect American dream, right? He had a goal, he had a dream, and by gosh, he went out and did it. It all seems like it should be that way. Or if you really want to laugh, go read Bill O'Reilly's book from quite a few years ago now. But read his book about how life is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a total lies one and the other. But what I'm trying to say is this. These men basically began, they had a dream. They had to work with other people to get their dream. In other words, they had to conform, okay? Yeah. But then they rose to the top. So it couldn't have been a top-down military thing where you're going to have to be a private forever. Somehow they got to be lieutenants and eventually generals, right?
Well, they also had to create the system from probably scratch, you know, after Paperclip and everything else. You know, when you brought it to America, they had to build a separate empire, and there had to be recruiting there. You know, it couldn't all be the old Europe satanic bloodline at that. You know, they had to start fresh at some point.
Yeah, yes. Well, all I can tell you is that so now we have all that were made in the system over the last, say, you know, three, four, five generations. And
right.
So there's, if you like, there's fresh blood in the system. If that's where you're going with it, I'd say, okay, fine. There you go. They're always bringing in fresh blood in that sense. Always looking for the next talented person that's just an amazing talent. But for that person to see the talent realized on the world stage, he's going to have to play ball with them, right? He's going to have to become one of them. So he's going to have to make a decision. Do I want to be, like, you know, famous and rich and to be able to do my talent and get paid for it and be acknowledged, or do I want to do it in a vacuum and... you know, have some, you know, struggle around in life and try to get through and have this thing on the back burner.
Right.
Well, most...
And, you know, you have, like, people like Kay Griggs, who I know you've interviewed. Speaking of her, have you heard anything of her lately? Is she doing all right and everything?
Well, we don't know. We want to talk to her again, and probably we will, but we don't know. To me, and I'll just be candid with you, it seems that she's still under control, not out completely.
Mm-hmm.
I may be fair, just from someone
right.
else who's got... I think she's a dear person. I really like her a lot. But still, there's some controls and things there. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's what happened to Bryce Taylor. She came out and did that book. She's pulled the book off the shelves and, you know, stopped the printing of the book, and she's wanted to go on. Hey, I did that too. I know what that's about. Well, you just want to forget about it all and just kind of put your head down and get on with life?
Mm-hmm.
But,
I guess where
see,
I was...
the risk is when you do that, there's a risk of being picked off and or controlled. There's
right.
a risk.
Well, it seems like they have such a choice before them where they you know, have been made and they, you know, are brought higher in the system because they show evidences of stuff like, you know, pedophilia. And in that regard, you can control them by... you know, having your pictures or whatever, and then also throwing a ton of money at them. So the choice is so obvious, like, well, why would I want to give up all this money and get all this exposed and my pedophilia and all this stuff exposed to me? The choice seems so obvious to them. So they it's like a lie, you know, they can't really enjoy. I heard what you were saying about Rupert Murdoch, you know, he could never really enjoy this thing that he's built because it's not him, it's not his, he was just a front, you know, kind of for it, and probably doesn't even know.
Ultimately, you go back to like, okay, the whole Hilton thing, you know, where was it, did he really have all that talent, or was it just a thing that they were all doing, you know, it's hard to say. Rupert Murdoch, did he do all that himself, or was it just something that was going to get done and he just happens to be a figurehead?
Right.
Who thinks he's in control, but really there's other forces at work. Most of the people that are made men, you know, and made women today, they'll say, well, they had guidance. And whenever people start talking about, like, spirit guides, a red flag, oh, there it is.
Right.
You
like
know.
Your David Icke's and stuff.
And I mean, you know, in the case of like famous musicians, Jimi Hendrix, Carlos Santana, and others have admitted having, you know, demonic forces, you know, bringing their talent along.
Right. And the more I look at the rock and roll thing in general, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's been a rock band that wasn't very closely associated with Satan and, you know, that's really ever been like the quintessential rock bands. All of them have been, you know, in some very key conspiracy manner, you know, very associated with Crowley or something or other, Crowley or whatever.
And Mind Control, certain other people, Timothy Leary, you know, these are all, but all those people are under control too. You say, well, how deep does this rabbit hole go? And the answer is, no one can find the end of it.
And
you know, no one
question,
can find the end of it. It's just that, you know, whether you're going to get in the flow of that system, and if you want to be a rock and roller today, well, look, there's been a lot of damage to the system in the last 10 years, right? You did admit that. In terms of exposure, I mean, look what you're doing today. You think this helps the system?
Right.
Okay. That it was unheard of 10 years ago, a show like this. Unheard of. It never happened. This is a recent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
If people would start talking like this and see, they'd be labeled crazy and they'd be locked up. That's what would happen. And then you'd see them again and they'd be like, oh, that never happened. They'd have my experience. They'd be like, oh, yeah, I was mistaken. I just want to work. Please leave me alone. Whatever you guys say, how many fingers are up? Oh, I see. Yeah, three fingers. You got
right.
It. Three fingers all day long, no matter how many fingers you put up, right?
Right.
And they learn. See, that's what I'm saying. Now, today with these shows and with the show you're doing and getting people like Duncan on and getting Russ Dizdar out there and he's doing podcasts and you've got podcasts and Rob Revere and his network and, you know, all this stuff. It's not a great time for the system. And I don't think anyone's been more critical of it than in a spiritual sense and outlining it. And, I mean, I've been allowed to do all that. So you see,
right.
There's obviously a lot of people in the system who want me to succeed. Have you ever thought of that part of it?
Well, I'm sure it's the fear. I mean, fear is the motivator.
They don't want to sit. Do you know that most people are in that system? They don't want to be there. You know, eventually when they come face to face with themselves, and their conscience kicks in, and you know, they're not just done. You know, just because they're there. We were talking about that earlier. You know, they don't really want that there, and so there's a good number of these people that protect people like us. And we do have help. And you may not ever meet them. In fact, you won't meet them. I won't meet them. But they're there behind the scenes. And they're helping. They're doing something for the Lord. They're doing something for good. They don't want us. And I don't hate them. You know, a lot of people preach about, you know, evil people. They preach about it like they hate the people. I don't hate them at all. These are all people I went to school with. And they're the parents. And they went to football games. And they... You know, they just wanted life. You know, they did what they had to do. You know, I'm making excuses for them, but I mean, I can see how. I mean, I didn't want to be a separate one. You think I want to be separate and have the brunt of all this everywhere I go? I've got crap every day coming on down on my head. I hate it.
Well, it's something that it's a worthy prayer to pray for, to break the bondage of fear, because it's what's keeping them from speaking out, and for this to just go supernova, as all these people in the system have been, you know, it's a fail-safe mechanism. They got systems set up to keep them from speaking, and a good majority of that is fear. And if that starts to crumble and everybody starts to see the beginnings of their walls crumbling, there'll be more and more breaking through. One question I guess I have here is, you know, you've been one of the kind of places that a lot of people go to when they're just coming out of multiple personality or satanic ritual abuse. You know, sometimes they're the first contact, you know, they're scared coming out of the system. What initial advice do you have for someone just realizing this, and what advice do you give them to help recover their memories and that kind of thing? What's that process like?
Well, number one, it's always good if you can do it like Judy or Duncan or others, tell your story, get on the air. And two, find a guy like Russ Dizdar. All these people are available. You can write me at metazef@gmail.com. That's metazef@gmail.com. And I can refer you, you know, to a guy like Russ, or they could get in contact with you. But to get some help, I did it on my own. And what did it take? How long did it take me to finally figure it out? You know, it was a spiritual issue. I didn't even know that for 25, 30 years. I'd hate to see someone else just flail around like I did for 30 years. It would be much better if they got some deliverance. First of all, most of these people are going to have deliverance. Jesus is the deliverer. He's the way, the truth, he's the only way out of this thing. So you need someone who's really for real that will deliver you. So I know Russ does that kind of work, and he's got people that do, you know, so there are people out there that do this kind of work. And we do deliverance. And even my friend Messiah in Dread in the Netherlands, who's, you know, a really, he's a deliverance minister. I don't think people really know that about him, but they will. So there's, I know two or three people that he's helped deliver from slavery, mind control. So really, it's slavery, mind control, slavery. Most of these people, they're afraid to get out. They're afraid. It's the same thing when you know, prostitutes have their pimp and they're afraid the pimp will kill them. So they're afraid. Right? It's very similar. Right. Most of these people have somebody or people in control around them, and they cower. They don't want them to find out. They're thinking about making a breakout.
And the psychiatric system is so damn dangerous, you know, for them because of the control of it through its hierarchy of the way it works. What are your views on that, and what of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation?
Okay, well, obviously, psychiatry planted a false memory syndrome in me. So, I mean, I'm sorry, they planted a false memory, i.e. that nothing happened. That was the false memory. The real memory is something happened, right?
Right.
The false memory is you had a fine life, but you went a little haywire and now everything's cool, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the role of psychiatry, to make sure that nothing, they work for the system, and the whole point of them is when you get some of these people that start waking up and coming to consciousness, their job is to get them back under control, get them back into the system, get them back and productive, return them to their lives, to their families, make sure they don't wind, or incarcerate them, or, you know, somehow encourage them to kill themselves. Not directly encourage, but you know what I mean. There's ways of using, say, what do they call that? Neuro-linguistic programming to kind of give people a signal they should kill themselves.
Right, and omega programming and all that.
If someone if someone's been programmed with self-destruct programming, which most every multiple that I know has a kind of a self-destruct, self-hatred thing going on, shame, guilt, self-hatred, all they have to do is push that a little bit, you know, and the person ends up killing themselves. And what happens? The system is protected. Or they go discredit them publicly, and I've gone through a lot of that, and, you know, making a mockery, you know, trying to make fun of me. And this has happened all along, even before I was on the Internet, even before that. This has been an ongoing thing of mocking and making fun, and that makes you feel like committing suicide too. So unfortunately, I hate to put it this way, but most of the people that come to consciousness, there's a real risk of suicide. Because they feel all alone.
But that's where Jesus comes in. He trumps the system, and it absolutely is too powerful. That's why they have so much programming that's associated with Antichrist mentality. Man, I bet if everybody remembered all the programming, they would just, you know, like some of the stuff I've heard. But just, you know, how much it's trying to discredit the love of God before even the idea can be planted.
Yeah, it's really bad right now, but that's because they're really worried. You know, they feel like, well, you know, the other thing they got to keep going to keep it moving, Chris, is they have to make sure that people don't run out of money, right? Because if they run out of money, they'll question the system. They'll get pissed off at the system.
Right.
Okay. So they got to keep this illusion of money and that, you know, and retirement, and if you just play the game, you'll be all right, you know, that sort of thing. Keep your nose to the grindstone, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, just do your time, and then you'll get your day in the sun later when you retire, a day that most of the time never comes for anybody.
Let's get into some of the stuff that these entities running the show here. At these high-level rituals, they're worshiping both specific demonic and geographical assigned entities and Satan himself. Sacrifices made to them for power. It's been this way for a long time. This is how such a long-term plan, in my opinion, has been carried out. You know, this whole New World Order globalization plan is really suggested at these rituals by these entities and by ultimately Satan itself. What percentage of the people are that are in the mind control system are part of this level of satanic worship? And I guess that's the question there.
I would have to guess, a guesstimate. But since most people that I've met seem to be somewhat connected to this system and they seem to all understand something about sacrifice, you know, what, 90%?
Right.
So that's the Bible kind of helps me come up with a number there, because if you add up in the book of Revelation how much death there is of, you know, a third and then a third and then a fourth, you know, I mean, kind of cumulatively add them together, you know, pile them on top of one another. Say, you know, like you take a third and then you take a third of that, if you take a third, and then say you take another third of what's left after that first third, and then you take a fourth of what's left after those two thirds, you end up with about 90%.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, unfortunately, you know, here's the really sad tragedy of this whole thing. When you're fighting this thing, you're fighting the whole world. You're fighting 90% of the people. They have the number. Most of them are not, maybe they're not hardcore, but they're all living with a terrible secret. You know, and I mean, people I run into, I mean, they all, I don't know, you know, who we can trust and who you can't. My philosophy is don't trust anyone but God. He's the only one that can tell me if someone's for real or not. I mean, I know you're for real. I can see this, you know, clearly. But I've seen other people too, and it doesn't mean you're not going through a battle for your soul right now. I'm sure they're hot on your trail too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Satan's on the trail for everyone's soul. That's really what we're talking about here. You know, it's one thing to sell out for a dream. In other words, you need the help and cooperation of society, so you're going to conform in order to get that help and cooperation so you can build your empire, right? Okay, that's what the American way is. So now you're going against even the American way. The good old USA, that's what it's all
right
about. But you need the help of other people. Can you be Mr. Smith goes to Washington and build yourself a great political career? Absolutely not. You can build no career. You're going to be ostracized and cast out.
Well,
the reason that I'm squawking, I think, is because I have a burden for children, because I just can't imagine most of the kids that I knew, they just didn't make it. You know, I did make it. I was stronger than them. But still, I'm damaged from it all. You know, I'm so outraged with that. It just makes my blood boil. You know what I'm saying? I just absolutely cannot stand. I remember being at a Christmas dinner in Alaska. Daytime thing, and with in-laws, and I remember there was a guy there that was a member of the Shriner organization, but I mean, I knew he was just a conformed jerk, you know, he was just a jerk. He was trying to bust my chops all the time, you know, but I remember there was this kid, he was just coming in, he was like, you know, 17 going on 18, one going to go to college, and I saw it, because, yeah, I can see all this really clearly, just because I've, you know, what I've been through. And I saw him start to order that kid around the room there. You know, but you know what I mean? The signals, I saw just the way it was, you know, I saw it, okay? X. Mm. I saw X going on.
Right.
And I saw him just dutifully doing, you know, and I saw him mind controlled. just like there's no. It's just like he almost had this kid on a remote control. Like if he had a little remote control thing, like a little TV controller, a little joystick, moving the kid around in the midst of the family, of a middle class family in Alaska. And there it was. I saw it all over again. That triggered me too. That triggered me. Then eventually I found out that my own mother-in-law starts making comments that are only trigger comments for satanic ritual abuse. I'm like, how did she get, this is Alaska, you know, person that votes Democrat. You know what I mean? Saying things like, the whole thing is raging there. So how deep does the rabbit hole go? Well, it's got to be 90%. It is the system, so it's got to be most of the people.
Well, let's. It's just such an interesting technical thing, like this UFO connection. I know that you have a very interesting take on this. One of the early preoccupations of this show was to explain the public perception of the whole alien thing is used to further not just the globalization, you know, agenda, but the Antichrist agenda, and that a lot of the people propagating it are involved in this dark system. Let's talk about what there's so many aspects of it. What are these aliens? Are they physical? Are they spiritual? What was your take on that as it stands?
Okay, well, when I was fighting them out there, I mean, back just there was some days where I was having to run away from them, and I found myself being these ships, okay, if you will. They were like triangles following me around. You know, I'm not crazy. It's really happening. And the explanation I was given is that, that if I would just give in, of course, it would be revealed that, you know, these beings, the aliens, if you will, and the flying around these triangle ships, are all connected in with these elites in L.A. And then further to that, they travel around on these ships. That was about,
right.
There was another testimony that no one has heard really regarding Bryce Taylor. It's a similar understanding of it exactly, but she's never written it in a book. That they fly around and go to different planets and whatnot, and that's been going on forever. Was it in an interview? It was? That she was like a cocktail waitress on the ships? Okay. She was like functioning as a cocktail waitress. I'm serious.
Don't deny it. After Stan Deo's, you know, take on all that stuff, it's not at all hard to believe now that we've seen the physics of the thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's seen the dark side. I think it scared the hell out of him. But he one time said that this was a WASP organization in Australia. On my interview, a WASP organization, and I can tell you he's on to something there, because that's what, you know, that's what we're, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, that was his take, and they were connected with these beings, and it wasn't like some Jewish conspiracy, because we have, you know how there's people out there screaming about the Jewish conspiracy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm throwing in the WASP conspiracy, you know.
Right.
And ultimately, I don't believe in that either, but I'm saying it's interesting, his take on that.
Right.
And then my take on it is, hell yeah, that, you know, the people that are connected in at the highest levels of society are all connected in with all the ships in Denver Airport and coming and going and different portals, and they want to live forever, you know. But they're given in, they get their heaven now, they get their wings now, they get a lot of stuff now, see. So that's really the deep, dark secret, that people have been involved and intertwined with this reality for thousands of years. And see, that's the deep, dark secret. That's why people get killed. Because it leads
the same
satanic, it leads to the whole satanic system, and that's why.
And it's like, you know, it's the old story, you know, where these interdimensional satanic, you know, demonic beings will trade us knowledge for any number of things, and just and knowledge of, you know, something that probably comes easy to them, understanding the physics of the world easily, can just throw us a technological bone here and there in exchange for the stuff that really means stuff, that really matters, you know.
What really matters, Chris, is about life. People want to, they don't want to die. That's the big pursuit on all sides. And they know Jesus is life, and when given life, we don't have to struggle. His blood gives us life. He gives us his life. We live because of him. But there is no, they want to do it another way, right? They want to actually become like, they want to become robots that don't die. They want to become cyborgs. And who would have an interest in cyborgs? Someone that would want to destroy the human genome, of course.
Right. I've heard you say it before. You know, they want immortality on their own terms, and that's technically feasible, you know, I mean, and nowadays, you know, and it's too bad it's not going to last that long.
Yeah, they want to, well, they can download them something of themselves into a machine, you know, and they also trade in souls. There is a market out there for souls, as the Book of Revelation describes. It's just a cryptic line, you know, and, you know, they talk about frankincense and myrrh, you know, and rocks and this and that, jewels and human souls. But there is a commodity involved. That's why they don't want to lose any once they have them. They don't want people getting free. They want you to be convinced that, well, you sold your soul, you got all this money, you did all this stuff, you're never getting away. They program them with that. Don't think you're going to get away now. You've already fed at the trough. You've already done the thing. You're not a virgin anymore. You know, it's over. And that's not true. You cannot sell your soul. Jesus paid for all the souls. All you have to do is make the choice. Accept Jesus. That's all you got to do.
Right.
There is no one who has lost their soul. There is something about blaspheming the Holy Spirit. There is something about the unforgivable sin. But the way I've understood it from the Holy Spirit is there's an unforgivable sin provided a person doesn't repent. You know what I mean? In other words, goes to their grave with this idea that, you know, the Holy Spirit is the devil, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that and knows better, but just has all this hate. I mean, if you're very wicked and you know, hate God and you know that God's good, so you have this whole campaign that God is hatred, God, and, you know, Satan is love and God is hatred and Satan is God and God is really the devil. You got this whole thing going on because of your hatred toward God, because you know that you want to get the technology, you want to live forever, you want to do all this stuff, and you're not going to be able to do it. Have your fun or have your program. You have to put a knife in God's back in order to get all that stuff. You have to be Judas in order to succeed on the world side. You have to forsake the Lord. And so what these people think is, oh, I forsook him, I did rituals, I did the deed, I sinned against God. I stabbed him in the back. I was Judas. I am Judas. There's no hope for me. And that's not true. All a person has to do is turn around. I want to make that clear.
Absolutely. And the devil whispers in their ear that, oh, you don't, it's not for you. You know, you've already sinned against him. Even a regular Christian won't pray because the devil's whispering in their ear that they don't deserve to ask for things for themselves because they have this sin in their life or that, you know. It's total lie.
Oh, gosh, yeah, we all get caught up in it. Sometimes when we get judgmental, we do the devil's work, and, you know, we think we're doing God's work, and, you know, and I'm sure during the Inquisition they thought they were doing God's work and killing God's children, you know, and or at the time of the Salem witch burnings, you know, the reports are they would find the most innocent one, you know, in other words, someone who's like an outsider, an outcast, or, you know, someone who's standing alone, a lamb, right? They would say, that's a person more likely the devil would inhabit because they're innocent. We should burn them at the stake.
Right.
That's our own history here in American soil.
There is a lot of confusion with the idea of the Nephilim of Genesis 6, and the problem as I see it is that the people want to give a blanket accusations of titles, i.e. that all our leaders are Nephilim or that all aliens are demonic, where I think more after looking at it that the truth is a bit more complicated and even technical. There seems to be genetic manipulation and the odd blurring of physical and spiritual lines, what with the, you know, them being able to do sleep paralysis things and then switch back and be actual physical to physically torture. What are your views on this technicality?
Well, that's a kind of a big question. I mean, there's, you know, you've got this idea, well, can a robot be saved? You know, is salvation even an issue? Or is a robot conscious because it feels feelings of love? You know, or says praise God. You know, could there be beings out there who are godly beings, even though they're manufactured?
So do you view the gray situation as kind of the Jewish mysticism of Golem, where a body, a cavity that is soulless, that is just implanted a demonic entity because of their desire for embodiment, their desperate seeking of embodiment? Is that a way out for them where they don't need the free will of humans anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do. They're trying to become, you know, free will creatures. They're just like, if you go back to the Book of Enoch, you know, the fallen angels asking Enoch, hey, buddy, can you, like, give a good word for us to the, we'd like to get back in and not be fallen anymore. Is there any way back? And they're inquiring, and they want Enoch to go inquire of the Lord if that's possible. Enoch comes back and says, nope. You know, the boss says no.
Right.
So if I go back to that, and if I work it from there, I would come up with an idea that, well, this whole passion that's going on has to do with humans. You know, and we seem to be the center of this big drama. We are the center of it. Oh, that's so humanocentric. It's like, no, or anthropocentric, rather. No, it's not anthropocentric. It just happens to be the truth. That's really, why would they all be coming and going from Earth? If there's so many billions of stars, what are they messing with us for? Why are we so important to them? Is it so they can steal our souls and jump into our bodies so they can live? Because they're desperate to live? Is that really it? Is that really what it's all about? Is that, or is there something else going on here? To me, it's like there's some kind of a battle going on where they believe somehow, some way, they're going to be able to you know, fix for themselves what they're after, which is, you know, ultimately to live and to be sovereign individuals of their own right, to be able to do what they want to do. And they somehow can't do it, and they're trying to use humans for a number of reasons. One, blackmail, right? Two would be, you know, harvesting souls, because they do something with the soul of a person, the essence of a person, that being that makes a person a separate person. Somehow they're using that technologically for something, you know. But all this can be categorized as under the limited way. In other words, the problem with the aliens is it's all limitation. And so the fallen angels, who are spiritual beings that want to download themselves into some kind of finite situation so they can walk around, in other words, the illusion is not enough. They're, in a way, trying to play God and be the creator and create something for them to be a soul in so they can walk around. The problem is, it's not their bat and their ball. There's this horrible issue. They can never get what they really want, no matter how much they do. And God's going to deliver his people, but he's going to give them a great chance to corrupt it, to wreck it. It's almost like in the book of Job, where Job, you know, where Satan is telling God, you know, you let me bother him enough, and he'll give it up. You don't want, he'll sell out. You'll see. Just we'll kill his family. You know, we'll do all this stuff to him, and then he'll finally be on his knees. You watch. And of course, this seems to be a big drama with the father. He seems to be very much involved in this. Other people would say, well, it's just logical. The devil can't win, so the devil knows that. So why would they even try? And the reason is because I don't believe they don't think they can win. I believe that that there is a contest going on, and I also believe it's multifaceted. On the one hand, they want souls to take them away from God. Okay, so they want to corrupt the human. On the other hand, they want to destroy the human genome because God created it. On the other hand, they want the human genome, but they want to be able to inhabit it and be a part of it. You know. On the other hand, the real motivation to the whole thing is they want back where they were with God, and they don't want to be cast out.
And I'll throw this one in, that it could be that, you know, by bringing souls to their side, they get more power or whatever they need. So this could all be done, in the genetic manipulation and everything else could be just a deception to make us think that aliens are what they've been telling us aliens are, a la Zachariah Sitchin and his propagating of that. And so that when that deception comes, it will turn so many people away from it. Then that could be the whole reason for it. Although, except you have the Genesis 6 Nephilim thing, where apparently their motivations were different. So I think it's a little bit of both, and in some respects as well.
Well, I think it's multifaceted, but I think there's always the same theme, and that theme is always there's a battle, okay, over men's souls. Yes, but I mean there's a great spiritual battle of them versus God.
True.
And at the same time, they, you know, they're made to want to take over the creation and be gods themselves, and yet they're limited. They're held back from what they want to do, and so there's this ancient struggle going on even without us being involved in it. And I think that ultimately it plays out within each human soul. Each person is going to be, you know, smack dab in the middle of this battle. And as I've told people, it's horrific. When you decide to fight the system or you decide to fight against that situation, in other words, you're not just going to let them kill you, because that's really what it is. It's like a spiritual death that you go through. You're not going to just lay down and die. Your life is going to be like being in a horror movie. And the only joy we're going to have is we can have the power of the Holy Spirit. It's the only thing that's going to give us the power supply we need for joy. Just for, how about making music or connecting with other people or rejoicing over the smile of a child or a flower opening or God's amazing. All that stuff will be robbed from us if we're just trying to fight them on our own, you know, with just the power of our finite power within ourselves. You know, right. I've talked to a lot of people lately that are bitter and downhearted. You know, they're just miserable, despite not being on the satanic side and even have waged a good battle and they even believe in the Lord, kind of, but they're just miserable, feeling like they're in prison. They can't go anywhere because everywhere they go, there they are again.
Well, you know, I mean, we are entering, as to borrow something from Chuck Missler, a time period in which the Bible talks more about than any other time in history, including the time that Jesus walked on the shores of Galilee. We're entering a serious battle, you know, the Black Awakening and everything else. Things aren't going to be pretty, but it doesn't mean that, you know, that it's not supposed to happen and that there will be victory. I think it's going to be an exciting time to fight this stuff and to fight the oppression on all levels. It's going to be very interesting, I think.
But one thing, Chris, every one of us is going to fight all the way to the end. You know, there isn't going to be a time in this world where you're going to be able to sit down and go, ha, well, we got that done, now let's enjoy ourselves.
Right.
It's always going to be joy, but yes, with always an awareness of, you know, be like, you know, Gideon, you know. you had bed down to have that drink of water, but keep your eyes on the perimeter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's as much as we can have. Now, what we've got to do is start learning how to love this situation. Okay, I get that much? Cool.
Right.
Wow, that's a lot more than I thought. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lord. Praise God. Praise God that you. Another day we got through. We talked to Chris and something didn't break. It kind of broke in the beginning, but we got through and all this stuff got said and it's going to go out there. It's like, wow, praise you, Lord. Thank you. You know, is it going to win the day? No. But it's another little victory.
Right. Let me ask you about something that I dealt with a lot early on. It was one of the things that I didn't understand right at first, but I think I'm getting a clear picture. Arizona Wilder, in her testimony, obviously she has many implanted memories, but she seems to be genuinely fighting the system. How do you see her in her testimony? What's the deal as far as you see it?
Well, like a lot of people, okay, you've got people like her coming forward saying that she had been mind-controlled and been a priestess and this and that, over presiding over rituals and things, remembering all that stuff. My feeling about her is that, and I'm not really totally familiar with her, but it's just that there are always people around, you know, and you just got to, with any of us, with anything that you hear, you're going to have to, you know, question. Questions come to mind, like, okay, because, I mean, I've never been a high priest of Satanism. You know, I can't imagine how you go from that to being a truth teller.
Well, she's not. I mean, she doesn't even see it as Satanism. It's the through a glass darkly that she's obviously so controlled. I mean, she's where the reptilians whole thing came from, because she had been through like a classroom setting where they told her what she will see will be reptilians and they're from Mars and this and that. So she's obviously describing a satanic ritual with all these people there, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
well, so. You know, I my prayers are with her. I hope she.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm concerned about people like her and Bryce Taylor and others. I have a lot of concern. I don't know what's going to happen with her. She's tied in with people that I know are not okay.
Right.
And I'm not going to go into that, but I'm just going to tell you that's my concern.
Oh, yeah, me too. Very much so. Let's just move on here. One of Duncan O'Finian's part of it that I find very interesting was experience where he describes his dad was visited by an old CIA buddy, left angry, and then this was followed by 3 days of UFO sightings and eventual kind of sleep paralysis episode, which was the last thing he remembered for several years, which suggests like at least a part of the CFO craft phenomena is controlled by the CIA or other government, and that some of the other sleep paralysis and stuff, and you know, we talked about Standeo, but my question is all this ties together, you know, the aliens, the demonic, the government, mind control, how are they all playing in the same sandbox? Is it because at some level they are literally is it just an attachment to the leaders? Is there like more of a physical interaction, like at a board meeting, like, hey, how's it going, this is what we're going to do today type thing?
The CIA are the babysitters of the world, right? I mean, when you come up through that system, most everyone I knew, they worked for the CIA at one point. Just they went through the CIA thing as a matter of course. They're all in the CIA. How about, you know, George Bush Sr., you know,
right.
He was in the CIA, then it turns out he was the head of the CIA.
Right.
They're all in the CIA. And in fact, when you start out as a young man, you start running guns and drugs. How many people I know, they're working in that whole Ollie North thing with, you know, Iran-Contra, and they run, you know, cocaine, and they run guns to MENA, Arkansas, and this and that. I knew people that were doing that, and they were just kids starting out, and you know, or you're an assassin, or you do something, you know what I mean, you do the kind of dirty work when you're younger. And then when you get older, so you do, you know, the CIA is always there for them to use, you know, and it's all part of, you know, the whole superstructure, the economic superstructure of the world.
Right.
You know, but they're all members of it. You know, one way or the other. They're all part and parcel of it. I think you talk to someone in the CIA, they would probably say, what you're saying doesn't make any sense, but they're in their own compartment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are people that work there that are like lambs, you know, that don't know anything about anything. They're just there, you know, pushing paper. They don't understand how it all works together. Very interesting, there was a movie... now I'm going to forget what it was. But it had the Skull and Bones in it,
Robert De Niro's thing.
Yeah, the De Niro movie. It was almost an apology for the Skull and Bones. It was amazing. You know,
yeah, I saw that.
In a sense, De Niro was just admitting that he's part of it. That was his movie. He's confessing that he's part of the system. That's how I read it.
I saw Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut the other day, and I was, you know, all these years I hadn't seen it. I thought it was going to be this great expose, and here it was, just a whitewash of it. Oh, nothing. It looks bad, but it's really not that bad, and everything's okay. Go back to sleep. It was like, damn, you know? I thought it was going to be
the Sidney Pollack character, one of the, quote, good guys, he's saying, I was concerned for your safety last night. Da-da-da-da-da. In other words, this woman loses her life because a life had to be given that night, and she basically offered her life in exchange for his because she was going to die anyway.
But then it says, oh, that was just an act. She actually died, you know, just because she was going to die anyway with the drug overdose. So we don't really actually kill anybody. We just pretend it was just to scare you. You know, nothing really nefarious actually goes down. Just sex. Just good times. See you later, you know.
Well, he did do more than a lot of people to show exactly what it is. That's exactly, Eyes Wide Shut is exactly what it is. You have to really study each scene. You'll see everything. But
right, I'm sure it was further than a lot of people have ever gone. But still, it was just kind of was a bit of apologetics, I guess, for it. But
Kubrick had to he before he became a recluse, he needed the use of that whole. In other words, by the end of his life, he was saying that was his way of saying screw you people. But any filmmaker out there that takes hundreds of millions of dollars to launch a film, to make it, and, you know, and then launch it with advertising, right? So he had the use of their apparatus, right? And at the end of his life, he felt bad about it. So he did that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, why would he become a recluse if he loved these people so much?
Right.
Here's the more interesting director, Roman Polanski. In the beginning, his breakthrough into America was Rosemary's Baby, probably... still, even better than Eyes Wide Shut, about the way it really is. There you saw how she tried to run off to another guy, you know, another OBGYN or another doctor, okay? And he was tied in. In other words, everyone outside that little coven, they were all tied in. And Polanski showed that. Later in his life, he does a film with Johnny Depp called The Ninth Gate. And that film goes on and shows a cynical side. He did his version of Eyes Wide Shut, in other words. But it was much more awesome than Kubrick's. Because what he does is he's got this Luciferian in the end. He says he's got so much power, he can pour gasoline on himself, light himself on fire, and he won't burn. So he goes ahead and does it, and then he burns. as if to tell the whole world, yeah, the system sucks. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And then you had people like bored of the orgies. Oh, yeah, the orgies, you know. And they weren't talking about, of course, the orgies and killing someone. They didn't go that far. But, I mean, the orgies, the ritual sacrifice, it's just, it's so much effort. I mean, I'm so tired of it all.
Right.
He had that sort of attitude in doing it, which I thought, it wasn't that, you know, the movie failed as a movie, but it was interesting how his career began with Rosemary's Baby, and in the autumn of his life, there he is with The Ninth Gate, you know, admitting that this whole thing's a sham.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I got to check that out.
Polanski was tied in with the system, right? Was it Robert Evans? Who was involved in that, in the producing of Rosemary's Baby? I think it was Robert Evans. But all these guys were all made men, all part of that system, all of them. And Polanski had to play ball with them unless if he was going to do the movie. And the movie was basically mind control of the public. It's saying, here, we're here, and this is what goes on, and you're not going to do anything about it.
Right. I think it's kind of part of the religion. I mean, that's why they love to do that kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah, it was very much a... it was Robert Evans. Trish, she's going to look it up. It was Robert Evans who is the producer. He also produced... I believe if he didn't do Chinatown, I think he was involved in Chinatown, and it was Polanski that was involved in that one too. Yeah, you can trace all the Hollywood information and then the films and the directors and things, and that tells another fascinating story about all this. Will you get any of those people to come clean? I doubt it on your show, because if they were to really come clean and talk about all this stuff, it would be like they would be a Judas to those people.
Yeah,
so they don't do it. They're not Judas to me. I don't know them. They don't know me. We're not connected. I'm not betraying anything. In fact, I'm hoping that this show can help to reach out to some of them. You know, they don't have to go public about repentance. But as we get older here, as we get a little bit longer in the tooth in the USA, and as things start looking really ugly and crappy around the edges, and things aren't quite working, I think we're going to see a lot of these people come out. They're going to want to know how to get out of that system, and we can't just tell them, you made movies, you were an elite society, you're of the devil. I get that a lot. Because of my own background, I can, no matter how much I went through and no matter how much struggle, I can never be forgiven because I came from them. Therefore, I must be something wrong with me.
Right, and I hope and pray that, you know, as this black awakening happens, there will also be an awakening of this, and God will shine a light on all their deep, dark corners, you know, and it will start to be exposed, and then people will come out because of that. It will be their chance in a lot of ways when they see other people happening and the bondage of fear being broken. What do you say to those who, are involved in your kind of Antoine LaVey kind of Satanism, say, I don't actually believe in Satan of the Bible and, you know, all this stuff. What do you say to those people that are in, you know, just kind of like, you know, the kids and stuff that are dabbling in all this stuff?
The only thing I can say is do it more. And I know that's going to sound controversial, but at some point it will fail. They have to hit bottom before they're going to give it up. And I just pray that it not only does it not work, but I mean that they all get burned doing it. Okay, so sometimes they need to get burned to get you know they're not going to. In other words, Chris, I don't think they're going to come out of it just right now, just because of the fact that, you know, Jesus is the Savior and that's cool and everything. They're still into it. So what can I say to them? Give them the standard thing. Well, you know, you better enjoy this life because this is all you're going to get, and then you're going to go to hell. They just start laughing at you.
Well, yeah, but
attitude toward me, you know, and I don't really mean that because a lot of them hurt children, but let's say they're not hurting anyone but themselves. My attitude is do it more. Get to bottom, get to the end game, get to the, when you finally see that they're not going to let you into the real Satan system. They're not going to let these kids in, these people that go out and they, that's the overt, that's the stupid Satanism. You know, these people are following the Anton LaVey thing. That's the outside circle. That's not any part of what's going on inside.
Yeah, but it still is like once people start buying your books on magic and are wanting to do the thing, you know, because, oh, whatever it is, Harry Potter or the rest of the total mind control thing on TV and everything else, you've opened doors for potentially attachment, and then that attachment will follow orders like a sergeant in the army, you know. So, in that respect, it's growing Satan's army as literal agents in the same way that I will do God's will because the Holy Spirit lives in me. They will do Satan's will, like it or not, because they have a demon in them or a series of them.
Right. Well, the only thing I can say about those people is if they want out, but they feel afraid and trapped, if you accept Jesus, he'll walk you out. We don't get ourselves out.
Right.
But like with most people with a problem like that, with pursuit of power, they need to hit bottom. So I just pray that the Lord just infects all their lives completely. It just shows them how awesome he is and how their power is nothing. A lot of these people that are in that kind of Satanism, when they see the power of the Lord, they're like totally, they become the ultimate, faith people. They become the ultimate of God's people. Why? Because that's what they're after. They're just going the wrong way. And when they see God, they just drop everything they're doing and they just run after him.
Absolutely. That's a good point.
There's a lot of them that are like that. They're just confused because they think that God is like this psychopathic, you know, killer that just hates sodomites and, you know.
Well, I think Russ Dizdar is a good example because, you know, here before he was such a spiritual seeker and before, you know, he was a young kid and actually very advanced in Hinduism, you know, it was a seeking. He knew that there was something that he was spiritually gifted, I guess, you know, and I think that he just went, you know, the wrong way, but when he found it, man, he sure did find it.
Yeah, Hinduism, like I was explaining about Krishna, how I visit a bunch of Krishna websites lately, and you see all the same kind of legalists versus the lambs, and you see this everywhere, Muslim sites, all over the place. I see the same things going on as in Christian sites. But a blue being that plays a flute and beguiles women and seduces them, you know what I mean? Follow the Pied Piper? Well, what's that? We all know what that image is, right?
Right.
They may be seeking God in Christianism, and I believe a lot of them are, but they won't find him. A lot of the people that are in Hinduism, they know Jesus is the Savior, but they're not going to give up their culture at the moment. You know, in other words, they understand. But if you do seek God, if you really want God, if you really want the spiritual walk, the spiritual life, which is the only life to live, Jesus is not shy. He will find you. You'll find him. And then, of course, then you have to make a decision. Are you going to be willing to suffer social ostracization? If you really follow Christ, you will be ostracized. You know, there will be that rejection. Got to get ready for that. But
right.
He is so awesome that who cares if you're rejected by people?
Absolutely. I got a few more rapid fire questions here. We're coming up on 2 hours. I think it'd be a good 2 hours worth of serious information for people. I just want to ask a few just random questions. One, maybe about a few people out in the Patriot movement, if you will. What are your eating habits? I usually like to ask people like that because I think it's so important that we jump off the food grid. Are you off that grid, as it were?
Off? I'm not sure I understand.
I just say that because all the weaponized food, you know, like, you know, just everything's all corrupted, you know, genetically modified and, you know, poisoned with MSG and aspartame and what have you, all that stuff. I wonder, what are your views on it?
Well, I think whole foods are better. Organic is better, you know, and you just try to do the best you can. I mean, use common sense and ask the Lord to bless everything that you eat, you know. But in terms of saving myself through food and being overly paranoid about, you know, the fact that they're corrupting the genome and you can't find rice anymore, you can't find... I don't know what to do with that. I just have to trust it. That's way over my head. Right now, I mean, that's so if you go to a health food store, you think you're getting good organic, but it's really all tainted. That's, you know, and they're trying to change the plant genome to change our genome. That's the scam.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I always bring up the fluoride thing and how important it is, because it's actually calcifying our pineal gland, which, you know, may have something to do with, you know, our spiritual life, you know, and I think that that is something that should be noted.
I just have to eat simply, you know. I have so many things kind of that I'm struggling with physically that I just cannot afford to eat, like processed foods and things like that. And you know, I really don't like eating non-organic. I like getting produce grown from local farmers, and I don't really eat much meat at all. Very little on occasion. But I don't go after the chicken, for example. I just turned off to that. So if I do eat any meat at all, it would be, you know, we know some people here that grow buffaloes, right? So we'll get their meat, because we get it right from them.
Ted Turner?
No, what's her name? Lamont.
I guess he's in Wyoming out there anyway, not New Mexico.
Lamont. Lamont has not to plug them, but they have down by the prison, there's a prison next to it, they have this whole field where they have the buffalo. You can go there, say hi to your buffalo. Hey, I'm going to eat you pretty soon. How you doing? And you can actually, you know, everything is clean. You know, you can see the grass they eat, right? It's all clean.
That's cool.
But then again, we don't know if that grass is tainted. So I don't know, Chris.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you can't. My biggest thing is just, you know, thanking God for every meal and ask Him, you know, to protect me from it or whatever. I mean, at that point, I think molecular structures can even be manipulated. I don't really, you know, I'm not crazy about it, but it is something I believe that in these last days we got to be careful of. It's not easy anymore. Let me ask you about a few different people. One I wanted to get your opinion on, a guy, Dr. Bill Deagle. What is your views on Deagle?
I don't know Deagle. I mean, people have talked to me about him, but I think you're asking me because he's controversial or there's a question.
Well, I go back and forth with him because it seems like he's talking about everything that we're talking about now. You know, I mean, he understands all this whole system and everything else, but there's just some questions, and I just can't. I just hoping you had a.
All I can tell you is a lot of people sent me over the years, you know, things from Bill Deagle, and I've always kind of shy. I've just kind of like, there's no connection there. I just don't feel a connection, so I move on. That's the only thing I can say. I don't. That doesn't mean good or bad about him. It just means I don't feel any connection for myself. It's interesting. You'd think that if he's talking about the same things, we would have gotten together and talked.
Right. let me ask you about...
I don't think he wants to meet me, though.
We talked about Kay Griggs. Let's see. Patrick Heron. I know that's a sore issue there. I want to see what you're dealing with.
Patty Heron. Well, I publicly stated my outrage that he's promoting the serpent seed doctrine, that Eve and you know, Lucifer, you know, had a romp in the hay and bore Cain, when Genesis 4:1 says that Eve knew her husband and bore a son, Cain.
So, I wanted to ask you, was that the PID radio interview with them that he said that? Is that where you heard him say it, or does he have another kind of...
He said it on PID. He said it with Sharon interviewing him.
Yeah, Sharon kind of called him out. Was like, Sharon. No, I don't think so. You know, she kind of called him out there.
But what's great about Sharon is she stuck up for the Bible. I mean, she said, "Well, now wait, there's some people that disagree with that." But yeah, that, and then of course just browbeating. I mean, when I interviewed him, he just wanted to take over the whole hour and talk about the rapture and how many 60 million Christians there were, and like we're taking. Just the whole spirit was just out of whack with what's going on. And of course, he will not admit. And no matter where he goes, he's not going to talk about, you know, he wants to talk about stuff that will get him on coast to coast, but he's not for real. I mean, he's not talking about things like, for example, what we just talked about. He's not talking about the spiritual battle. He doesn't seem to have any persecution. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I don't think he knows it. I don't think that he's a conspiracy buffer. You know, I don't think he knows any of that. I got the impression from him that he literally was given a very important thing with this Nephilim and the Pyramid thing. And I think that it makes sense and it's biblical, except it's almost like it was given to him and he just kind of didn't really understand the implications. It was kind of almost oversimplified in his end, like, hey, I solved the mystery of the pyramid. See you later. Let's see what else is next, you know?
Yeah, but maybe I think that
I got the impression from him. I interviewed him as well. I think this is a while back, one of the first interviews I did, but that it was, that he was susceptible to certain things like that. And when I got the impression, I heard that independently of the PID radio interview, and I heard him say that, and did kind of seem like he was throwing it out there. Like, it, this whole thing is bigger than him. I remember, like, what he understands, not bigger than him, but, you know, what he understands as far as I don't think that he would believe certain things are even happening.
You know, I've got to, you know, deal with people that are going to be for real, that are not in this Christian thing as a business, and, you know, and I just can't deal with that kind of mentality. And I've said all this stuff publicly, so, you know, Patty, if you're listening to this, you know, it's not meant as anything against you. It's just that I've got to draw a line. I can't promote people that, you know, maybe some of what you say is helpful, but in general, I can't promote people that are in this thing for the wrong reasons. And that's my opinion. You know, and doesn't mean he's a horrible person. Doesn't mean I don't like him. It's just, you know, can't go there. Plus the book, I'm sorry, I read it. I, you know, gave it kind of a rave review at first. And then after I looked at that and looked at some of Gene Scott's research, Dr. Gene Scott, I'm going, is there an echo in here? I'm seeing some of the same conclusions.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, that's good. I got one. Well, let's see. I got two more things. First of all, let me just continue with the people. Good old AJ, how do you view on his and Alex Jones and his and everything he does?
You're just asking all these controversial. You're going to get me in a lot of trouble here.
No.
I don't know what to make. He became a millionaire doing screaming, yelling against the globalist New World Order takeover, takedown of America. We got to get America back, patriotism, and all that. The other thing is the Patriot Movement itself. If he's emblematic of it, let's talk about the wider issue. The Patriot Movement itself has kind of gone New Age. It's really gone anti-Christ at this point. It's gone secular, if you will. And in that, I think that's its undoing. So I think it's a failure of a movement, and it's a failure because it's a spiritual battle, Chris. You got to look at it from that standpoint, or else you're going to... I can't tell you how many people that I subscribed to on that when I was on MySpace who were just... Like, one guy is saying, you got to get guns right now and start shooting people. I had to take him off. I couldn't believe it. I thought, is this an agent provocateur? I mean, what is this?
Right.
You know, but you have to admit, okay, this whole thing needs to be, the final thing I saw was someone sent around a picture of Bush, evil Bush as an evil Satanist with a big cross on his lapel. You know, in other words, that this Christian thing is wrong, too. You see happened to the whole thing? You know,
absolutely. I'm very concerned because you know there has to be a waking up of everybody. I mean, from American Idol, they have to make it from American Idol to Alex Jones without being corrupted into zeitgeist. You know, and there's a split that's going to split the whole thing on.
That's a good word for it. That's good.
And there's a split that's going to be happening on dogmatic grounds. They're either going to go to zeitgeist or they're going to go, and Alex Jones helps break that whole mold. First of all, it has to be done, and who's better to do it than this crazy man who if anything is not controlled by anybody, you know? You got to give him that.
All I can say about him is that I really enjoyed the first few videos during the time right after 9/11, and I would pass them around to people and they would get so angry at that, and that was pretty cool. So, you know, he's made his contribution, you know what I mean?
Right, and I don't think that, you know, I know that, whatever.
That I know that are very angry with him because of, they say that I'm not, that he's putting out disinfo along with his PSYOP partner, what's his name, from Prison Planet,
Paul Watson, that Scientology stuff and stuff. I mean, he addresses that stuff every day. People are calling him and talking about Jesuits, and he's a Jesuit op, and he's a Scientology op, and, you know, the evidence isn't there. I'm not trying to defend the man. I'm just saying that.
I can't go there either because, you know, Frankie is, you know, my partner in Zefnet, and the guy that makes it all work miraculously. He's always listening to Alex Jones because he goes, you know, this is some great shit the guy puts out, you know.
Right.
So he's, you know, it's like if Alex wasn't there, Frankie's day would suck a little more. So I'm kind of like, because right. He's going to corporate America. He needs something to listen to on his iPod to get through the day, right?
Right, there you go.
So if you need something like that, I'd say I recommend Alex Jones better than, you know, Fox News.
Fox News, hell yeah. Okay, well, let's see. I got one more here, one more series, and I think we're about good here. What and all this stuff that you've done how over the years in your broadcasting and interviewed all these people, how have your views on all this changed? Is there any particular thing that you were just dead wrong about that over the years you've learned from? What are the main things that jump out at you, if anything?
Well, I was dead wrong about I was very naive about the system versus not in the system. Okay, I just thought anyone that's a Christian on the internet was just like me, you know, that we, you know, and then when there were conflicts and things, you know, other agendas, you know, there's other plans or games were going on involving me, you know, the same games from escaped from L.A., those games were going on amongst people calling themselves Christians. I was very depressed at that. I was very sad about that. And I'm sorry, my part in it was I embraced a lot of people that had, you know, I just wanted to be friends with people, you know, and so I put their stuff on the air, and it wasn't really, you know, eventually I corrected the record, but I'm sorry that I ran out and I just got all these people to come on the air that, you know, that ultimately wouldn't have been honest for me to do, you know what I mean? It would, not that it was dishonest, that I didn't believe, but I just thought, I don't know what I thought. I guess I just thought that we were all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that there were people out there pushing, you know, so I've been a non-commercial guy, but there are people wanting to get on the show and to boost their Christian careers.
Right.
Who don't really believe in any of this stuff anyway behind the scenes.
Right.
And, then, you know, I'm sorry that other things, was I wrong about, you know, some of the conclusions I finally came to on people? Yeah, only that if I made anyone think that I didn't like someone or that I was judging them or, you know, condemning them to hell or something early on. No, that wasn't it. It was just a disappointment over the fact that I learned something about a person that, in other words, it just was fake, or they were only talking to me for a certain reason. You know what I mean? And I was promoting them, and then, oh, gosh, you know. But anyway, I escaped all that. But the price is this, Chris. So I don't have a daily show on, you know, on the Genesis Network or whatever. That's what I could have had I just been willing to be more of a mensch. Only I just couldn't. Something in me, you know, also went off that way. So I'm also guilty of not being a good another thing is, you know, getting in, you know, then speaking my mind, and so I seem contradictory, where I'd say, hey, this guy's great, then 2 weeks later I'm saying he's awful. So now I don't get in that situation in the first place.
Well, I know that I probably turned, hopefully, a lot of my listeners on to you. I hope that they will start to listen to you. You have an interesting format of how your shows get going. Could you kind of give your website out and how it all works over there and all that stuff?
Well, basically, zefnet.com, and also, you know, Predicto is our really fun, great. And you know what? I'll just say it right now. If you want to post, I would love to have your post there. If you want to be a poster, okay,
right on. Yeah,
I will send you an invitation because your voice would be very much appreciated. It's a public service, you know, but it's predicto.blogspot.com. We make a little fun out of what we call prophecy smack because we realize everyone's addicted to this end time smack, right? And so we call it that. But it's basically we're saying that to keep ourselves honest. To not take it so seriously, because you get a lot of information coming across. But anyway, ZefNet, we put out mainly radio broadcasts there. During the week, it's me as Z, the preacher, so I preach all week, kind of. At least that's what we've been doing lately. I also do what's called a news fix, where I kind of go through the news in like a 15-minute format. That is going to be actually syndicated on a big shortwave, a really global shortwave coming up very soon. We bought that back to tie it in with Predicto, because what I'll do is I'll read the news. When people post on Predicto, I'll read it the next day on the news fix, and then that goes out to the world. And I give credit to all the people that post.
Oh, right on.
Okay, then Sunday is the real day that's we're on WBCQ The Planet, and we broadcast a four-hour format from 9 to 1, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Spirit Talk Sunday, it's called. That's our guest show, so we'll have, like last week, we've had Duncan O'Finian and Russ Dizdar and Brother Thomas, who's another prophetic voice out there, and others. We've had people that are billionaires on there who are just out there. You know, they're atheist billionaires who are trying to, you know, bring about global change for the better, things like that. We've had all kinds of guests. So
yeah, certainly have.
I don't want to say this about the, you know, a lot of the podcasts we had, you know, before when we were on the WWCR, before when I was on RBN for a while, and then I just had guests every time. So that's, those are why we built up such a great a grouping of guests in our podcast. Do I want to do guests during the week? I would like to do guests during the week, but I've had to reassess the whole thing. Lately, the Lord's had me preaching all week. What do? Go into the Bible, get a word, but it's asymmetrical in the sense that there's no set schedule. You might get four, you might get 6 hours of preaching in a week, and then nothing the next week. All depends if the Spirit moves. Will that continue forever? I don't know.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that's the freedom of not being tied down to any, you know, any situation or anything like that. I love that.
I won't pick the mic up unless I've got something that is really there to say. Usually these things go for an hour and 20 minutes without, you know, like a freight train. And I don't even know where, you know, it's, believe me, it's not a job that I really want. I really wanted to just be a musician. So can we talk about that?
Right, yeah. Please what, do.
Oh, yeah, you can subscribe to the Zeph Report in iTunes. So, yeah, or to any podcast like podfeed.net or, you know, Podcast Pickle, whatever, and then you'll get all the shows. You can also subscribe to the feed right off our site and get all the shows to your desktop. You know,
right.
So whatever we do. Musician, Boy Interrupted. I had all kinds of musical gifts as a child, and I was all interrupted because of, you know, my own testimony. But then that's come back into my life beginning a year ago at this time is when I actually started again after like 30 years off. But I've been playing, you know, I've been keeping up with my kid drumming. I've been keeping up with that all the time. You know, actual live drumming and percussion and bongos and congas and drum synths and all that. But, I mean, music production I've finally gotten back into, and I go under the title of Metaverse, under the name Metaverse. That may or may not be a continuing thing, but we have four albums on, I say we because you'll also hear Trish Daniel, my wife, has a great voice. She sings on some of the tracks, and I sing as well. Not such a great voice, but a lot of passion. Anyway, four albums on iTunes. If you have iTunes, you can go there, listen to the tracks, see if you know, download one or whatever. We also have a CD called MetaV at CD Baby. That you can actually go there and get for, if you buy two, you get them for $5 a piece.
Right.
You can't beat that, right?
Right. And you can get your books at Amazon, can't you?
Yeah, Amazon, and also if you want to know anything about me as a musician, you can go to 4dmusic.blogspot.com, 4dmusic.blogspot.com, 4d, just like it, not 4 written out, but the number 4dmusic.blogspot.com, and usually I put all the we get out there. We've been played around the world on podcasts and different podcasts like UK, Romania, USA, obviously, Australia, New Zealand, and just around the world. So you can go check that out there. And some of those podcasts are pretty good. You may want to subscribe to those as well.
All right. That's Zeph Daniel. Zeph, thanks so much for being here. It's been more than just a little enlightening, and I really appreciate you stopping by.
Thank you, Chris. You do excellent work. I've heard, you know, some of the interview with Russ and also with Duncan. Your interview is absolutely outstanding. I just, yes, please keep going. And I'm, like I say, I'm going to invite you. So get ready for your invitation.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll see you later here. I want to talk to you right on the other end of this. So that's it. See ya. That's a, oh, shit.